Thank you. And yeah, my name is Hank, and I'm a PhD student with Florian at the University of Waterloo. And today I'll be talking about
fundamental stuff that we've been working on and is coming out very soon, hopefully. We've been working on this for quite some time. But yeah, just an introduction about what we mean by categorification and engaging the gauge. And also have some application about that kind of technique and mechanism to what we call anomaly resolution. So let's begin. So to recap, what we all know is that the concept, the notion of a gauge theory, where it came from. So essentially we have a global symmetry, it's a group G, and then it acts on fields through a representation. Or generally, you can just think of like matrix multiplication or whatever, and then it acts by just multiplying, right? There's an action on the value of the fields. But if it's a global symmetry, then this G value, this group element, is going to be constant throughout time, right? And by gauging, what we mean is just very simple, just promoting some global symmetry to a local one. So we allow the symmetry parameter to depend on space, or depend on whatever the parameters that our field depends on. So now we look at, okay, how does the derivative transform, right? So how does the derivative transform? Well, it picks up this additional term here.
Thank you. Okay, so essentially what we found is that the derivative actually does not transform covariantly. It is actually this Nablet term, the covariant derivative. You know, it's kind of tautological that we call it covariant derivative, but okay, I'll just hold this. Okay, so, but notice here that what's the covariant derivative here, it defines a connection. Like I'm using words that we haven't developed yet, but it is what it is. It's a connection, but it's also flat. So keep in mind, when we gauge something, we get something flat. And by looking at how the derivative transforms. So that's kind of the main idea. And this is, as I said, this is the birth of principal bundles and gauge theory as a whole in like the early 20th century. Mid-20th century, I would say. And there's this very classic reference by Baez and Moon Yang that you can check out. So the overview of this talk is that I'm just going to introduce a notion of what we mean by gauging the gauge and categorification and see how they're related. That's one of the main points. And then following that, I'm just going to talk about one application of this concept. And this application is really related to the monopole stuff in U1 Yang Mills. And also I'm going to develop an anomaly-free theory in which I can study monopoles in Yang Mills, but in an anomaly-free way. I'll explain what that means later. So first of all, what is categorification? What is a category? I mean, so a category is very simple. It's just a collection of objects, not even just a set, but a collection of objects with relations. And these relations are encoded by maps between the objects. So for example, you can see like these bullet points, these denote like certain objects, etc. And then the relations are maps between them, the arrows, right? So the arrows can go from one object to another, can go from itself, go back on itself, it's a loop. And it can also form like squares and triangles and etc. So examples include the category of sets. So the objects are sets, and the relations or the morphisms are just set functions. Or another example is the category of topological spaces, right? Where the objects are topological spaces and the relations are continuous maps. And what is categorification? So by categorification, we mean we add one more layer of structure to our existing structure, essentially. So And these are called two morphisms, and these are morphisms between morphisms, essentially. And there's a whole bunch of like cohesion like laws that you have to satisfy between them, but I won't talk about that because it's really annoying. But an example of what a two category is upon categorifying is, well, the two category of categories, where you have two morphisms as natural transformations, for example. And we're going to see the key example here is that if you categorify a group, right, which encodes symmetries, if you categorify a group, you get a two group. So this is a known construction in mathematics. Like it's out there, or like it depends. Okay, so I wrote two group and groupoid. These are two different notions of categorification. One's horizontal, one's vertical, but that doesn't matter. We'll see two groups mainly. Okay, now moving on to our next key notion, which is gauging the gauge, quote unquote. So recall that in gauging a global so-called zero form, so a global symmetry, well, yeah, global symmetry, what we did is that we look at how the derivative of a field transforms. So now we look at, okay, now we have a principal bundle, principal G bundle. We have a principal G connection, A, and we form its quote-unquote derivative, which is the curvature, right? It is covariant under the gauge parameter, gauge transformation, which are called zero form, right? Because G is just a function, it's a zero form. It's called a zero form gauge symmetry, but it's also invariant under a shift by A, by alpha, rather, of A. So this one form, this alpha is a one form, but it has to be constant throughout time, space-time, and also central, in the sense that it's in the center of the Lie algebra. And once you have that, you have this symmetry of the this shift symmetry, and it's a one form. So this thing is actually not new. People have been noticing this, and for example, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, and also in QCD, there's a one form Zn symmetry, which is related to like monopole confinement, stuff like that. But yeah, that's we're not going to talk about that mainly. But here, so now we want to gauge this global one-form symmetry, right? We see that we have a global one-form symmetry, and let's gauge it. Let's just say that alpha depends on time, space-time, rather. So now we say that, okay, let's not only do that, and not only let alpha be just any random valued in any part of my Lie algebra, my gauge Lie algebra, but also I'm going to let it be valued in some other Lie algebra, and I'm going to let the shift be implemented by some other map called the T map, this T which goes from H to G. So I'm going to allow all that and then allow alpha to depend on spacetime. And if I do that shift and I compute the derivative, I get this extra term, which is T of dA alpha plus 1/2 of alpha squared. Get this term. So I'm going to say that, okay, this defines for me a flat two connection, right? Because recall, what we did with the constant, just the usual global symmetry stuff, what we saw is that the covariant derivative, when we gauge the global symmetry, the covariant derivative picks up the this flat connection. So here, similarly, we saw that our derivative picks up this term, and we're going to identify it as a flat two connection. So if you have that emergent structure, then you see that you have a two group. So a two group is defined with respect to the T map and also the action. So this sideways triangle is an action of G on H. It's going to satisfy certain conditions. These are called like equivariance and Pfeiffer identity, but it's required for, again, the like the cohesive laws. These are required, but I'm not going to like introduce that to you, but the key thing is that now we have a two connection, A and sigma, and sigma is a two form. It's a two form connection. It's an actual connection with this following gauge transformation. So we have the one gauge transformation, which is just the usual, you know, G acting on sigma. Also, I have a two gauge, which is just this guy, right? So I just take that guy, I put it here. That's the two-gauge theory and how a two-form connection transforms in a two-gauge theory. So what are the properties of a two-gauge theory? So the properties are that, okay, I can form these covariant curvature quantities, which are the fake curvature. You can show that it's a covariant. And in fact, under a two-gauge symmetry, which is the shift, right, by A, it's actually invariant. So it this quantity is actually completely invariant under a shift. And also, I can form the two curvature, which is you can do the computation, and it's covariant as well. So what we've seen is that if we gauge a symmetry, which is governed by just the group, we gauge the underlying global one-form symmetry, we get a two-group. So what does that mean? It means that essentially gauging, this gauging operation, is equivalent to categorifying our underlying symmetry structure. And this is very important to keep in mind, because like keeping in mind the picture of all the arrows and the arrows between arrows, you can see that sigma allows us to define a surface holonomy similar to how a two category, basically like you draw some pictures and a two category just gives you like two cells, right? Or rather two, like stuff that looks like surfaces essentially, but like that's not just a pictorial correspondence, it's concrete. And the third, also very important point to keep in mind is that the one curvature F, not the curly guy, the one curvature F is now a gauge freedom, right? So you see that if we just take a non-trivial one, if we take a trivial curvature, or rather a pure gauge A, so that the curvature is trivial here, right? I can do a shift and you get arbitrary one curvature. And it's a gauge transformation. So I can do a gauge transformation and get like any one curvature I want, essentially. And also, secondly, the Bianchi identity, which is kind of like a property, is now data in the sense that it's two flatness condition for my two-gauge theory. So this echoes the fact that categorifying is essentially encoding property as data, and then now, like one more higher level, your property of a two category is, well, it's something else. So, and there's also, two Bianchi identity and stuff like that, which is now three form, but never mind that. Okay, so why do we care about this? Why do we care about categorifying and two groups and two gauge theory and stuff like that? Well, one of the main application of this structure is that we can study anomalous one-gauge theories with a two-gauge theory, which is anomaly-free. I'll do this with, for example, with the anomalous Maxwell theory. Anomalous because we have a monopole, right? The electric sector, d star f, equals the electric current, but the magnetic is df equals star j of m, where j of m is the magnetic monopole current. So this guy is non-trivial, not zero, but it enters as equational motion df, which is a violation of Bianchi identity, which means that your one-gauge theory just doesn't make any sense. So the theory is anomalous. You can't gauge the one-form, the U1 zero-form symmetry. So how do we solve this? Well, to do this, we introduce a two-form sigma and just impose this condition, where over every surface, you integrate over every surface, I'm going to say that, okay, my holonomy of my sigma is going to match the monopole charge. So this here computes the monopole charge. So you can imagine, like, I have a surface enclosing the monopole defect, essentially, and 3 plus 1d, I have a surface, and then I compute my curvature. If I have a monopole, I compute that curvature around that surface, I get something non-trivial. In fact, it's an integer. Integer is like Dirac quantization condition, right? So I impose this condition. So this condition suggests a fake flatness quantity, right? F minus sigma is zero, but not on the nose, right? But only up to exact two forms, which is, you can see that because I'm only imposing over closed two surfaces, I have this quantity, not open, not anything, closed surfaces. And if I use Stokes' theorem, this guy goes away, right, under the integration. So this shift ambiguity is in fact a two-gauge transformation for my sigma. What that means is that I actually do have an underlying two-gauge structure in my monopole Maxwell's theory, and this is encoded by the two connection, which is valued in the two group here, where the T-map is the identity. And this is a generic fact, where if you want to resolve your anomaly in some, let's say, unformed anomaly, let's say you do some BRST computation and you get some anomaly polynomial in which is an unform, you can introduce an n plus one form, which absorbs that anomaly like this, like this matching condition here, can introduce that, and then you get an n plus one gauge structure, which is trivial in this sense, in the sense that your top level T-map is just the identity. And here you can see that, okay, I have a two Bianchi identity, which is fine now, right? E squared sigma equals zero, two Bianchi identity, and K is, remember, K is the two curvature, right? So it's just here, it's abelian, so it's D sigma. So I show you that this shows that the two gauge theory is actually non-anomalous. And also this whole setup is relevant for what's called the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation, which is done by Clay Cordova in this paper. So it's like not new, but it's like a very step-by-step pedagogical way to kind of see where this two-gauge structure comes from. Like it's not just thrown at you and stuff. Okay, so following that, what can we do? What can we do with this two-gauge structure, right? So essentially the idea is that a monopole is the holonomy of my two-form connection. It is my holonomy of my two-form connection. That's the central idea. So if I can do that, right, if I can encode my monopole charge as the holonomy of a two-form connection, I can say like, okay, I can study anomaly-free version of Maxwell's theory, but with a monopole, which is just encoded in sigma. So I can say like, okay, my one-gauge structure is actually now completely anomalous now, right? There's no violation of one Bianchi identity, and F has no monopole, so to speak. I just shove like all the monopole data into sigma. And as we saw before, sigma satisfies two Bianchi identities, so there's no anomaly there as well. And I can do that, right? So I can just form the what's called the two Yang Mills theory, and I form it with the curly F, which is the fake flatness, F minus sigma. So now, okay, what do? I source my monopole using the current that sources sigma. So it's a two-form current, and I can essentially get like the form of the monopole charge from this relation. If I have this relation, and I source my two Yang Mills theory with this term, and I do, you know, dynamics, the equations of motion, I find that, okay, I get this up here, which means that my two-form current, which sources sigma, is related to the monopole curve. But the theory is not anomalous. I want to emphasize that. And once you source both your two-form sigma and your one-form A by the electric current, just the usual non-anomalous electric current, right? If I source this guy and this guy, at the same time, I can derive a higher another theorem. And this another theorem is this. So it's not conservation. It's conservation modulo this current, electric current. What does that tell us? It tells us the conservation of dipole charge. So J is actually the dipole current in the sense that if you have, right, if you have an electric, say minus E like this, and you have a dipole moment like this, then E minus, so the charge E and the minus charge E, it cancels out. So conservation of dipole means that these two guys can just move together, right? I can move these guys together with the same separation, right? I can just move them and then dipole charge is conserved. But, yep, if I move one of them, I can move one of them, then this is not going to be zero anymore, right? I just move one of them, which means that my dipole current is no longer conserved. And that makes sense, because if I change just the distance, the dipole moment is not going to be the same. So this two-form J really is a dipole current. And this has shown up in like the analysis of lattice systems with subsystem symmetry by the paper by Dobinkin. And also it's noticed by Predko like a few years ago that it's fracton-like, right? It's a mobility constraint on my electric charges and isolated charges are immobile. So to conclude, what I've shown is that, well, to conclude, I can tell you that we've done this, which is continue the procedure. I start with two-gauge theory. I do this whole gauging the gauge, anomaly resolution. I get a three-gauge theory. We worked out explicit examples. And some very interesting stuff actually happens, which I don't have time to go over, but it's related to like string theory. But the key point is that gauging equals categorification. So this puts a very concrete physical meaning towards what categorification means and why, like, as physicists, we should really care about stuff like this, because it allows us to just go up one dimension, right? And you can see this from anomaly resolution, where it's essentially telling us that, okay, anomaly on the boundary can going one more layer up in my gauge symmetry, my gauge structure, like going to the bulk, and anomaly on the boundary can be matched by the anomaly in the bulk. That's essentially what the anomaly resolution is telling us. And it's like bulk boundary matching, that's right. And applications to, like, there's all sorts of applications of this two-group theory to like all areas, essentially all areas of physics. I mean, I don't know much about like fluids or you know, stuff like that, but Predko has a paper which relates gravity, like this sort of two-gauge, tensor-gauge theory stuff, to gravity, to like lattices and subsystem symmetry, like fractons, for example, or this lattice disclination. So it's like a classical statistical mechanic thing. Like this, there's this triality, but it's, well, it's very interesting, but I'm not going to go over it. But yeah, that's it. Thank you. Yeah, here?
Can you just like kind of say more what that means? I think I was a little confused.
Yeah, so of course. So essentially what I mean, so it's kind of like a categorical language that I use there. So what I mean by property versus data is that data is something that you encode in your category or in your structure, right? So when you say that, okay, I have a gauge theory, and you, okay, you have, I have a gauge theory, I have a one-form connection, G connection, principal gauge bundle, and then you just compute the curvature, and then you compute this guy, right? You compute this guy. It's one of the Cartan structure equations that it's zero. So that's property. Like, that's not data. You don't input, like, a priori, when you define your principal gauge bundle, you don't know this. But it's property. It's just you compute it, you just get zero. But here, what I'm saying is that when you categorify, this becomes data, right? Because I'm saying that, okay, my two curvature, if it's flat, right? Flat is data. You say, oh, my principal gauge bundle is flat. My principal bundle is flat. If it, now I say that, okay, my principal two gauge bundle is flat, that will force this. Yeah, so that's now property. And data is, well, this, sorry, that's data, and property is like two Bianchi identity. Yeah. So everything moves up 1 degree. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, can you go to slide 5 or 6?
Here?
Yeah. So alpha is your gauge parameter? Or what is it?
Yes. Yeah. Alpha is the two gauge parameter. Yeah.
And so if you take A to be to a spin connection, for example, and you, then you shift it by some gauge, And then you would introduce something like fake torsion and fake.
Yeah.
How can I? Or do you know what would happen if I don't take alpha to be gauge in this case, but just.
Don't take alpha to be gauge. So you're saying.
So, yeah, I'm saying I would then have something like a curly F, which is flat.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I know I'm on a non-flat solution in gravity, for example, because I do have curvature.
Right. Yeah. So, no, exactly. That's. Essentially, you're thinking about like doing anomaly resolution, quote unquote, with BF theory, let's say, or BFBB, for example. Yeah. So, we have a section on that in our paper where we looked at what is like the emergent two group symmetry, because in BF theory you actually do have, it's not just global, like you can do this shift. So, and the shift can just be any function. Like, I believe the relation is, so Florian did this, like, last week. Let's see if I remember what he did. So A is the spin connection, and similar, phi. So I'm going to do a covariant derivative on my frame field. Let's say 3D BF theory. So this is d a of phi, and this guy will shift by e phi, something like that. Yeah. So you can see here that it's not covariant, that not in covariantly exact form, but it's a one form here. Yeah. So it's a one form shift. So in BF theory, you actually do just have. A one-form gauge symmetry, like in BF theory. And then you can encode that in the structure of a two-gauge theory. Like, you can do that. And now, when you say, I have a particular form of my curvature for my spin connection, let's say you have a particle, or you have the BFBB, which is the, or BFB cubed, which is the cosmological constant. If you have that, which sources your one curvature, then essentially what that's doing to the two-gauge theory is gauge fixing, or picking a particular gauge for your two-form connection. That's essentially condensing one of the gauge symmetries of your theory. That's a very good question, but to unify the language of high energy and gravity. So I think what Nicola means is it's related to how you can treat gravity, like the metric tensor is a tensor gauge field. And tensor gauge field is an example of a two-gauge theory. But it's a pure two-gauge theory in the sense that you only have sigma. You don't have A, you only have sigma. And you can define that. It's what we call a pure two-gauge. So in that sense, if you wish to kind of unify that kind of language, then, first of all, we have to develop like the dynamics, essentially the charge algebra associated to a two-gauge theory, which is undergoing work. So for those of you that have been to Lyon, oops, this year, like that's what we were talking about, like the Heisenberg two-group stuff, which is essentially the dynamics associated to a two-gauge theory, and that's the basic kind of like the building block. If you want to quantize a two-gauge theory, that's what you start with, essentially, right? Because Poisson algebra is semi-classical, and you promote that, you deform it to like a quantum product, right? Like the Moyle product, but it's graded in the sense of a two-group. And you have all this properties that shows up and stuff like that. That's also a work in progress.
You can continue
that. Okay. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.